Welcome to the Leadership Labs with DeepRec.ai, a podcast where we delve into the fascinating world of deep tech entrepreneurship, company founders, and venture capitalists. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey. In each episode, we explore the minds behind groundbreaking technologies, the visionaries who dare to push the boundaries of innovation, and the investors who fuel the growth of tomorrow's game changers.
And welcome. I'd like to welcome this week's guest, Ewan Hauer, who is currently working as a principal at Apex Ventures, making his way through there with a background as an angel investor. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about capabilities of deep learning companies, founding them, particularly in a world where open AI, generative AIs are controlling the space. What do you need to own to stand out, to be unique? We'll talk about some founder's advice, understanding that product market fit, the strategy, your USPs. And then overall, you know, what does it take to be a tech founder? What skills do people have? What skills do people miss? I guess overall, what do you not see enough of? And within that, I'll let Ewan come on and introduce yourself. Welcome to the show again, Ewan. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Yeah, no, really, really good to have you on board here. So look, I mentioned sort of high level topics, what we're going to talk about, areas we're going to hit on. But yeah, why don't you kind of just give me a bit of an overview, a bit of a background into yourself, how you've seen yourself go from entrepreneur to angel investor to working with Apex?
Yeah, absolutely. So my career actually started as a PhD in quantum physics from the Heidelberg University, which was a very deep scientific part of my life, very structured, very analytical, understood the basic fabric of nature. And then I actually wanted to understand a different part of the world, which is business. Which brought me into management consulting. So did a couple of projects around data technology analytics at Oliver Wyman. Got lots of exposure in corporate venturing to understand how large enterprises are looking at startup innovation and how they can actually leverage startup innovation, which spoiler is also a nice exit case for some of those startups being founded these days. So that brought me into corporate venturing. I worked for a Bosch division that was looking for innovative startup solutions in their products and processes. So we're looking at robotics in manufacturing, things like decision intelligence in sales and marketing, computer vision for appliances and products, but also synthetic media generation for promotional material and training videos and so on. So quite a broad range of applications of use cases, but all with like a deep technological root in them. And so I got to see a lot of deal flow, what we would call it, and a lot of interesting startup ideas and startup teams, obviously, which brought me into angel investing. So I started, you know, putting my own money into some of those startups, and eventually actually joined one of them myself. So to get some startup exposure, some operator experience. It's basically an AI recommender system, if you will, to match startups with large enterprises. So to do this on a scalable, mostly automated way. And that brought me to venture capital because I saw, you know, I have sort of this somewhat unique or not that often found combination of deep technical expertise in quantum physics, but also on the business side, you know, go to market and being realistic about how to talk to enterprises and how to get really a first customer and a second customer and a third customer. So while I was doing mentoring and had lots of startup exposure, I thought, you know, I should really bring this together into a focused venture capital way, and this is how I started at Apex Ventures. Now as a principal, where I focused on quantum tech, future of computing, space, and artificial intelligence.
Nice. I mean, incredible background to come from a PhD in physics to go corporate, to go startup, to go VC, to even work in one. You know, you've been around the clock. How do you feel, I guess, look, before we jump into things, how do you feel that sort of benefits you having, you know, worked in, and maybe you can tell me, you will see innovation happening in Bosch, which is going to be innovation geared towards their areas, their domains, lots of tech expertise there, versus, let's say, like Techstars and other, let's say, AI emerging companies. Who moves quicker?
I mean, I think so. What I've learned from being in all of these different areas is that they're all bubbles, right? We're all in our bubble, and there's different bubble sizes, right? And if you look at venture capital and the startup ecosystem, and for example, I live in Munich and it's vibrant and it's like great exchange and community and so on, but it's still a bubble, right? And if you're in a large corporate, then you're in a different kind of community, right? And I think what's important is to get some level of understanding for the other side, you know, put yourself in their shoes, because it's not always easy, right? If you can be in a large enterprise and really want to innovate, but not be able to because of governance, processes, or, you know, the culture around you that doesn't let you innovate, and some people leave, others stay, you know, and get broken in a way. So I sympathize with them, but I think it's really not easy to say like one way is better than the other. So startups are looking for customers eventually, right? They're building a business, right? And the large businesses were startups at some point, and they have matured. So I think finding the right way to collaborate is really the key here.
Nice. Then I guess like working it backwards, or I'll call it working it backwards again, for you and your personal experience going from these larger corporate businesses into a startup world, do you find the startup world more exciting now? Is it just because it seems to be you've gone from, as you said, Bosch, Oliver Wyman, to your own angel investing, Glassdoor, Techstars?
It's certainly a much higher pace, which I think is part of the excitement. But I must say, especially the last couple of years, where maybe a bit too frantic. So we're seeing now this correction, right, in the market, in terms of funding, in terms of founding activities, and so on. And in a way, that's a good thing, you know, to slow down a little bit, to focus a bit more on, is there even a way that I could become profitable in 2 or 5 years, you know, and not just go for the double hockey stick hyper growth in every case. That was different, like even 2 years ago, right, in some cases. So it's even more special in my area, which is deep tech, because I think most business models and ideas are a bit more grounded in technology and in IP, and I would say a bit deeper value add, which probably still remains even after the hype is gone. Like some people are calling quantum a hype right now, might be, but I think no one really doubts that if it works, it will add substantial value to the world. Whereas having another e-scooter or a shorter time delivery of your food to your doorstep might not be, you know, what the world needs right now. So
unless it's done by like a self-driving drone, it's not that wheel. That wheel's been invented too much.
exactly. So I think it brings us back to more. A more sustainable type of innovation, and I mean sustainable in all kinds of areas, like even like from a business perspective.
Yeah, and I hate to say it because they're a German Berlin-based business, but you could really see during the I don't know, I would call them the boom times, whatever people want to say them. But, you know, it was companies like Gorillas who were getting valuations in the billions when the companies were founded like 12 months previous. But also underlining building, like underlining on their software wasn't anything novel, right? You had Uber Eats, you Deliveroo, all these companies were all there. They put a new face, or they put a new name on a technology and said, we don't deliver from restaurants, we deliver your groceries from supermarkets. But I mean, if, and it's not a big if, I mean, there's very few even businesses that do food delivery from takeaway restaurants that are valued at 1.5 billion. So I don't know where or how it happened, but Gorillas managed to surpass this, you know, 1,000 employees in like 18 months, 1.5 billion business valuation. But there was companies doing it already, you know, in other spaces like Getir. You know, it was just, I personally never understood it, but you could see the hype was just going crazy.
Absolutely. And pretty much the same thing is happening now with AI. Right. And there's a risk that that actually will happen again, because it's the newest trend and the newest hype. And again, some areas of what's happening in the space, even of generative AI, is not sustainable in that aspect. It's not something that will endure the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, I think what my personal feeling is, I don't think we have enough engineers to make it go into hype overdrive. There's not enough people that can actually build generative AI products and video and text and images for us to see massive businesses scaling out. There's some small businesses that I'm seeing now that are, you know, generative AI driven, coming off ChatGPT, even just ChatGPT 4 as well, that they have certain extensions, which I know we'll talk about that in a bit, what's the best way to go if that is an area you want to be in. But yeah, I mean, I think with the lower access to talent, higher costs to training software, I think the barrier to entry is quite tough.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, the question is really where to get talent from, right? And even as an enterprise, again, it's quite hard to reskill your workforce, right? And prepare them for the future, for what's coming and for what's already here. So I think, again, most, there's a high percentage of people that are open to it, at least very, very interested. And we saw this from even like registration and usage numbers of ChatGPT. I think many, many people, at least in the knowledge worker ecosystem, have had some exposure to it and have used it, but it's not yet, you know, part of the corporate training or some kind of more strict curriculum in large enterprises to be really mandatory, right? To have at least a basic knowledge of what these tools can do and how they work, right? At least on a basic level. I mean, it's very hard to imagine, you know, how decisions are being done on hundreds of billions of parameters, but, you know, at least to get a basic understanding for what's happening in the background.
Yeah, and I see a lot of, because, and it's I don't know, is it a benefit, is it a challenge? Because GANs are so new, you know, people are now studying them in their education, in their bachelor's and their master's, in their PhD thesis. They've only really been coming sort of mainstream in the last 2-3 years. So there's not even that many people that are out of education that have that level of experience to do it. But as a result, a lot of companies that want to do something with it are now collaborating with universities, research institutes. But again, the challenge with that is also, how productionable are these models that, and I, again, not to take away from a student, but the models are being written by students who've never worked on a production grade software product before. But that's ultimately where there's almost this pocket in the market of the people that know the most about GANs. that haven't yet finished education and haven't actually got that experience. So it's kind of like a really odd situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's why I think it's important to have a really diverse engineering team, product team, really people of different kind of backgrounds, age ranges, and so on, that are looking at least at the results, you know, and how they calibrate. If you have human in the loops, that can really give some feedback on what the models produce, and on top of that, I think we'll have some saturation of the model landscape with more and more open source models coming out, where it's not so much the model that's differentiating, but the data, right? Yeah. And so you would have to have subject matter experts, and those can be of all kinds of different backgrounds and again ages and cultures and so on, that really have a deep understanding of a vertical, of an industry, and of what kind of data to use to calibrate your model. And then the model really becomes the commodity and the data becomes the value add.
Yeah, no, I know. And I guess this is leading us perfectly in. So we can talk about it on deep learning companies for one. We can talk about it in generative AI companies. Let's start off with generative AI and work back. It makes it a little bit more clearer. But how different do you have to be from Google or OpenAI to be competitive in the generative AI space? And when I say be competitive, I also mean like you as a VC want to look at them differently, right? As I say, if OpenAI becomes closed AI tomorrow, how much trouble could you be in as a business? I mean, like what differences do we need to see?
Yeah. I think one key aspect, and that's probably the main differentiator or the lever that smaller companies have, is to build trust. To build trust in how the data is being used, and also trust in the results. So, the idea here is of explainable AI, right? To be able to understand how a result or how an answer came to be, and have the algorithm and the model be able to give you some sort of hint of why it, you know, classified a certain object, or why it gave you the recommendation to continue with or pass on a candidate, for example. And there are some great examples, for example, of Aleph Alpha in Heidelberg with their Luminous model, which have really, I would say, benchmarked that notion of including explainability in their model. So you can actually ask it why it did certain things or gave you a certain answer. And that will give you much more trust on inputting your own data into these models and, you know, sharing. Because the more precise of an answer you want to have, the more you will have to be able to or willing to share, right? It's like with a normal conversation, at some point you have to give something to get something back. And why would I put, you know, my secrets or my most valuable data into this model if I don't know what's happening with it and what the model is doing with it? So I think on that aspect, and there maybe even the big players are sort of already too big, or that they're shooting very wide, you know, trying to capture all kinds of different use cases. And so figuring out, you know, what a more focused approach can be, I think makes sense, but you very much have to be careful not to become just a ChatGPT add-on. Like if you build your business entirely around, you know, an API on that and some a nice user interface on top of that, I don't think it's going to be defensible over time.
And so I was going to say, maybe not even over time, but if we look at the short term, the 6 to 12 months, we've even had Elon Musk, Sam Altman come out and say that they wanted to stop the development of large language models. They don't know, the development's going too fast, right? You've got things like that being said. If you are building an API, and this might just be a personal gut feeling to you, if you're building an API add-on to a ChatGPT, is it something that you would already not walk away from? Are you probably too late? Have people probably moved, let's say, 6 months ago, that it's a little bit too late now even?
I mean, I tend more on the technical side, so I would say it's not deep enough. Again, looking at some other types of businesses, you can probably ride the hype for a few years even, but it's not our style, and we would rather look at something. Do we believe that this technology, that application, whatever class of products, you know, still has use and a benefit to the world really in 10 years or so? And if that's not the case, then it's certainly not a good investment for our fund. So another thing that for example is very appealing or interesting to me is sustainable AI, right? So how can you make all of those computations and models that are running more efficient, right? To just, you know, save computing power and carbon emission by that. So what is really necessary? Do you just go the brute force approach, you know, like open AI and spend, you know, $500 million to train your model? Or can you do, you know, 80% version of that for 200,000? So, and are there things in between where you can have clever algorithms and a clever architecture that helps you to compress data, you know, to make data streams more efficient, that actually help to train your models in a less, yeah, let's say, brute force manner?
Yeah. And I think this is where over the last 3 or 4 months, I've started to see the trend flip a little bit more. You know, you've got products being built that are helping big pharma companies with the heavy documentations that they have to write to maybe go and have their products certified in the case. Same with people assisting that in legal, in AI products that might have to be like medical, doctoral related. So they're being used in this sense, much smaller targeted data sets, much higher quality results. Again, the costs are not going to be in the $500 million, you know, but they're definitely providing the case. And I feel in the future, like microservices, micro products will be where the real value is added.
If the results and the answers that come out of those models are reliable, right? If you can really, and in the beginning you will fact check a lot of them, and if they're hallucinating too much or just, you know, giving out wrong facts, then it's not going to be a great experience, and it's going to be quite dangerous, especially in the medical and pharma field, to write, you know, marketing copy. There's not so much that you can really do wrong there, right? As long as it sounds natural and appealing, you can kind of let it, you know, pass. But if you go into more yeah, technical or health related issues, then it really has to be spot on.
Yeah. Nice. So yeah, wider subject. What is defensible? You know, what's to stop someone coming out and taking some of the innovation from Bosch and saying, right, this is our product, this is what we do now. We do IoT AI fridges that tell you exactly what level is on every product in your fridge, how low you are, and we update you when you're passing a shop, right? This, I know these are like research topics that have all been happening. How much different do you have to be to something that's already there or a competitor?
Yeah, I think so. I already touched upon the speed aspect. So you have to be very fast in order to develop your idea, just, you know, faster than your competition, which in that case, you know, if you're a startup, then your competition can be a corporate, could also be your customer, right? But another thing that you really have to have as a team is sort of let's say curiosity and humbleness to speak to the customers. Like, I've seen it so many times that in a large enterprise environment, you have, you know, methods of agile, you know, working and types of design thinking workshops and so on. But they're all kind of very theoretical and very, within your bubble. And not often enough people really go out and speak to the users or just rely on some abstract focus groups and so on. I think that closeness to at least the user, but sometimes also the customer, so the person paying for it, in early product development is crucial, right? And there as a startup, because typically you are kind of forced to do that. If you don't do that, you die off pretty quickly. So you are forced to do it, but then some are doing it better than others. So I think this is a large differentiator of how startups really go about their product market fit in the end, right? Product discovery process, how fast they learn, and how fast they can actually turn these learnings back into new features or some adaptations, or in the end, of course, a better user experience.
Nice. And I know you, look, people hear it all the time. It's all about fail fast, POC fast. Do you think, in some cases, do you even wait till you have a POC? Or are you better off visualizing in some really bad slides what you want to solve, and then getting 10 people who are in your target market and say, right, this is what I want to do. This is how I want to help you. Like, is that too early? Do you feel you need to have something to show?
I think it always helps to have a hypothesis about what your customer or again user needs, right? That's your hypothesis, and to test it out quickly. If you think about, I mean, there's different ways to test it. You can even test it with VCs, right? Because they are just they see a lot, or we have a quite large exposure to all kinds of different technologies, but also business models. And so we kind of have an idea, let's say, about what could work and what couldn't work. Of course, we don't know everything, and some things just need to be tested, and might and will often surprise us. But I don't think it's a general way to say, you know, when am I ready? When can I go out and show my product? Typically, the earlier the better. And if it goes towards POCs or some type of contractual agreement or collaboration with a larger company, again, the leaner, the better. So if you can get some money for it, even if it's to have some skin in the game, great. You know, if you can do it small and quick, it's always better than a large chunk down the road. So try to do it as lean and as quick as possible. Mm.
So someone's coming in to meet you, whether it's, let's call it, through your angel investing, through Apex, what level of research do you expect to see for that, you know, product market fit, to their value add to their customers? How much do you want them to know?
Yeah. So we typically require what we call a demonstrator. So something which is, you can think of it as a prototype. Again, we're dealing with deep tech topics. So, you know, it has to be something which is on a hardware side, typically done in a lab somewhere in a university or research institute. So and that's the beauty about it. Yeah. The students have, and PhD students have access to those kind of facilities to produce something, no matter what, you know, size and slowness and so on, but really something that just proves it could eventually work, right? Which is, again, beyond just a PowerPoint presentation and a research paper on an idea that, you know, this should be possible. So that kind of shows you a demonstration how this could, in principle, work. And then ideally, and that's kind of the next step, is to have one or two, maybe three customers or you know, let's call them project partners that are really interested in it and want to give it a try, even to invest some time in your technology and solution, right? That's already a cue that could be something of value to them, because that's how we try to reduce the market risk, right? In deep tech, we always have a technological risk and a market risk. So we want to reduce the risk on both. That's our minimum requirement. And then, of course, last but certainly not least, is the team. So we look at technology, market, and the team. And the team is really about, you know, how do they understand themselves? Like, what are the missing skills? You know, is the team complete? And do they really know what it takes, you know, to get to certain stages of a prototype, a POC, later scaling, and so on? Doesn't have to be perfect from the beginning, but the clearer the vision is and the understanding and self-reflection of the team, the better.
Oh, good. I guess, look, something that maybe not that you might struggle with so much, right? You've got that sort of AI specialism, that quantum background where it's very high-end, very high-tech, deep tech stuff. There are also some people that are out there talking to VCs that are not so deep tech. How would you, or what would you advise to them that they should maybe talk about their goals or talk about what they want to do, but not to overcomplicate it, right? So we want to talk less tech, more goal, product, vision, and ultimately revenue. But if you're building a deep tech product, chances are you're going to be a deep tech guy or girl. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's always important to not, you know, fall in love with your technology, but fall in love with the thing that you're, the problems you're solving, or even the customers that you're catering to. So I think it's very important for any founder, regardless whether it's deep tech or not, to research and understand the VC they're talking to. And you can cluster them, but for the very important ones, I would really go very specific and very individual. And there's enough sources like LinkedIn and so on to really find out who those people are, what they're interested in, you know, what their thesis are, what their passions are, and relate to that. I mean, authentically, but then you see if it's a good fit. And I think those are the best investments where you really, you know, hit a nerve, basically, that you're doing exactly, like you're building something which the VC was waiting for the last couple of years, you know, to pop up, because it really just so aligns with what they think should exist in the world. And then you don't have to go super deep into your technology or all of the backbone, but really paint more the picture of what good it can do.
Yeah. Nice. We did also, you've mentioned about, you know, founders, what you look for in founders, teams and software. When we talk about the people themselves, and again, I know there's no magic formula from this, right? You might get teams ranging from four people who've just finished their masters are like 23. You might have a mix of people that are all coming from business, sales, tech backgrounds. So not to paint any pictures here, but if there is skills that you look at having more value to founders, what would you say they would be? So people want to really focus on something.
I mean, my favorite founder type is a chameleon, really. It's someone that can adapt and can really take on different forms, different perspectives, right? You want someone who's very sure of themselves, who's really convinced in what they're doing, because everybody knows it's going to be very tough. The journey there is like incredibly hard. It's going to be very tough situations. And so you can never, you know, lose your vision and North Star. So someone who's really passionate, who's even, you know, able to sell it a bit and really convinced. And at the same time, maybe towards sort of the end of the conversation or the first pitch or so, really be reflective and say, you know, I know we lack certain expertise in the team, or we haven't made great progress in the last 2 months because of this and that, but this is how we're going to change it in the future. And to really, you know, not oversell it and make it sound like everything is perfect, but really build this honest relationship, open about what needs to be done, because the VC will find out sooner or later. And if it comes from the founder and you know that they're, you know, can reflect on it and they're aware of the shortcomings, whatever they are in terms of, you know, market positioning, we don't have any customers yet, but we're going to talk to 10 people next week and so on. There's really all kinds of different areas that this can apply to, but I don't see this too often, unfortunately, that founders will be so open and radically honest at the end maybe of a conversation.
Do you know what? And I must have had about 15, 16 of these conversations now. Reflection hasn't come up, but planning has. But I also firmly believe good reflection results in better planning, because you then actively know where is your time being spent, where it's good versus bad. But that's a really interesting way to look at it. Is it, besides that, let's say within your case in tech people, there's obviously the obvious ones that they don't have the experience in, right? You might have your computer scientists who don't have experience in sales, finance, marketing. For those types of people, if they're looking to come in to better understand these, like, what would you recommend to them?
The very least we can do is, you know, to advise them and try to help them with that reflection, you know, and give a mirror of what we think is lacking in the team, maybe in terms of experience or skills. And then it's about finding, especially, I mean, that's the magic of a good or great founding team, right? That they have, you know, at least 80-90% of those skills that you're looking for, and then you can think about the first, you know, key hires and sort of VP level and so on. But to have it mostly, let's say, covered within the, say, 2 to 3 co-founders. If you don't have that, it's not a showstopper, right? You can still be in touch, you can still, but we need to see some progression there. We need to see that people are actively looking for a co-founder, and it's not always easy to find someone because that person has to, you know, be at the right time in their life, be able to commit to such a journey and have a passion for the product and so on. But this is something that really needs to develop, because otherwise the journey of finding your co-founders continues while you also have to develop the product. And this is just too much.
Yeah, not to deter people, but you mentioned there, like, you know, you want 80 to 90% of the skills really makes it successful, right? I believe it's a similar stat. It's like 80 to 90% of unicorn companies are made by people over the age of 40, and that statistic comes in is because these people are the chameleons. They have that experience most likely upon reflection. And they're able to do a couple of different things. I mean, you know, if you're coming out of university or you're quite young in your career, chances are you've not really been told, yeah, do sales, do some customer meetings, and do some, you know, prepare some finance reports. You got to learn a profit and loss of a business if you become a team manager in most cases, right? And these things all happen with career maturity.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, there's cases where you can sort of compensate that, you know, you can, there's a bunch of great, you know, programs, accelerator programs or programs that help you to find a co-founder, communities and so on. This is just part of sort of the homework or the good preparation that you need to have before really going into VC, because then you're already on the radar. And then sort of, I think people or founders underestimate that the clock is already ticking, you know, once you're out of stealth in a way, even though it's not public, but people know about you, they will track your progress. They will look at you over a couple of months and see, okay, what has changed, you know, because that's, again, one of the few indicators that we have when we look at people is, you know, how have they progressed over a certain time? It can be weeks or months. And if you still haven't found a co-founder, then I'm going to ask why.
Yeah, that's a good one. People aren't on top of you. They are still watching, particularly if you're in a space. If you say, hey, I'm in green tech company, but I do deep learning, and our product is, I don't know, computer vision or NLP, right? That's most likely going to hit something that is very specific and very interesting to VCs that have that focus. I wanted to talk quickly on, like, you know, vision strategy. You've already mentioned about, you know, USP, but you've also mentioned, you know, don't marry it. So keep everything to where you are. But I guess what I want to talk to you about is not only that, but is the messaging of this USP, right? And look, technology changes, USPs change, communication changes. It's all completely fine. So it's just part of startup life. It's pivoting. How would you best tell people to communicate their USP, not only internally, not only to themselves, but if we talk about externally, how that should be done?
What we see currently is, again, we have the latest trend, you know, generative AI, or maybe even AI in general, is that people are using this, and I don't know what the statistics are, but I think 60% of pitch decks have AI somewhere in them, because people are just are using it sort of as a, okay, I'm on top of the trend, and I think that already is very hard to sustain as a USP. So when you talk about your goals, or even your why you're best suited to go into a certain industry or start a company or start a business there, I would always try to formulate the goal, mission, vision, whatever it is, on like at least a 10-year horizon. So just to average out all these kind of blockchain, yes, no, metaverse, who knows, maybe even quantum, maybe it's not even quantum, it's what do you want to do with quantum? Right? You want to do some climate simulations. Okay, climate simulations are probably going to be there in 10 years still, because climate changes fast now, but not really that fast. I mean, it's still climate. So there's certain things, certain trends of the human nature, you know, that take years or even decades to change. And so it's not about pitching, you know, a specific quantum architecture. So it's going to be ion traps, so it's going to be photonics. No one knows, you know, what it's going to be. Maybe they all will coexist, maybe not. So don't pitch me like a certain architecture, but pitch me, you know, what you're going to do with that. And then you can say, and I believe that doing this with photons or neutral atoms is the better way because XYZ. And then that's kind of a nuance of your greater vision that should still be true in 10 years. Right. And then I think if that's sort of your bar, a lot of the things that are being said and pitched today are do not qualify for that.
Cool. Similar enoughly on the same topic, but it is a little bit further on, you know, but I think it's very important. And I mean, it's important because I think a lot of people get lost in the tech, that they forget the reason why people join to work for them. You know, they join because you deliver excellently in an interview process. This is our vision. This is our strategy. This is how we're going to help. And in some cases, those people will only hear about the vision and the strategy once a month, maybe half a year when they have like a half year catch up, maybe once a year at an AGM, right? It's quickly not going to keep, you got to disengage your employees. It's not going to build a positive company culture. You're not going to have these people go down to the pub, and I know this is a weird thing to say, but they're not going to tell their friends about how much of a great place you are to work, how excited you are, how they're working on some of the most interesting challenges in the tech space right now. How should you sell the vision and strategy to your employees, particularly your early stage ones, right? Because early stage employees, will have the biggest impact if you talk about over a 5 to 10 year period. You know, they'll have the biggest impact in your vision, and they'll have the biggest impact in internal growth in many respects as well, and setting that long-term culture.
So what I think is most honest and authentic is certainly to keep the same messages and the same formulation of your vision internally as well as externally. So if whatever you pitch to VCs or the media or to your customers or and then your employees should really be the same thing, right? I don't see any reason for it to be different at all. That said, it's really, really not easy to formulate such a vision, right? If your vision is to make the world a better place, that's a bit too vague, right? I mean, I hope most people have that as a goal, but it's not differentiating anymore. So it doesn't mean so much anymore. Whereas if it's too specific, then again, it doesn't hold up to that 10-year bar. So you will have a lot of back and forth and iterations of your vision and what you really stand for. You can even, you know, change it. And I invite founders to take at least their early employees, like the first 10, 20 and so on, when the company is still like young and dynamic, to really co-create that vision and get feedback from, like, is this really what we're doing? Like, we started off doing this and that, you know, making a better world. But actually what we found out is it's more natural to do something else, maybe a little bit. And so you will have feedback from your own employees, and that message you can then reiterate with VCs, with customers. And so it's kind of it takes a while to converge to a good mission statement.
Yeah, I think you mentioned your first 10, 20 employees, get them in, get them involved. And I think this is what I use the term creates culture architects. And I don't mean they're layers and layers of it, but I mean, eventually you're not going to be able to impact the newest person in the door, right? But your earlier employees will always be. So if you can instill your culture into them, they will be your culture architects and essentially act as you did on that first day, resulting in overall that messaging to be more clearly delivered as it comes down and as you grow and scale. Are you ready for the quick fire questions?
Sure. Let's do it.
First one, I want to talk and ask about your inspiration, motivation, right? You've started again and again. What keeps you hungry to do it again? I mean, you could have always stayed with Robert Bosch.
Yeah, I think at some point it was really learning new aspects, new perspectives, right? And kind of feel that converging now. So I kind of see myself staying in VC for quite a while.
Good. The best book, podcast, or content that you would recommend to other leaders?
Besides yours, you mean?
I get that a lot, but this isn't even live yet. It will be.
About my episode. There's so many. There's so many.
You're looking over at the bookshelf.
Yeah. I don't know right now.
No worries. What are your 3 non-negotiables that you either set yourself or you set for your teams that you work with to ensure success?
Honesty is one. Reliability, if you promise something, to really be able to rely on other people. And the obligation to dissent. So really be able to criticize each other in a constructive way, of course. But that's how we grow as a team.
It's another really good one. Last question. What would you change if you were to do it all again? What would you do differently?
I might have chosen a different startup ecosystem to do my PhD in, and then I might have turned out a deep tech founder myself.
You know what? Interesting one, but you know, deep tech wasn't around so prominent back then, right? It was the term people were probably talking about, big data back then, big cloud, right? There was just so many different things, but I think ultimately deep tech is going to be like software. I think it's just always going to be here.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I think that does us for time. So everyone, I'd like to thank today's guest, Jón. It's been an absolute pleasure having you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Pleasure was all mine.
That concludes another enlightening episode of the Leadership Labs podcast. If you found today's episode thought-provoking and informative, be sure to subscribe to the Leadership Labs on your preferred podcast platform or on YouTube. Thank you once again for joining us on this journey through the Leadership Labs. Until next time.